You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Bruce Almighty. When Emma Heming married one of the world's most famous movie stars, an alpha male with a wink to beat them all, she didn't imagine the fate that would ultimately befall either of them. Now, as Bruce Willis grapples with frontotemporal dementia, his wife and caregiver tells Anna Peel how she is helping others through the experience of the longest goodbye, with photographs by Norman Jean Roy. By the time she understood something was happening, that part of her life was already over. Emma Heming Willis did not yet know that her husband had frontotemporal dementia. The disease, known as FTD, affects the frontal and temporal lobes of the brain, which control a person's language and behavior, how they perceive the world and exist within it, their personality. These sections of Bruce Willis's brain, the sections that had made him an international movie star, and much more crucially for Emma, a protective partner and exuberant father who could find fun anywhere, were dying. What Emma knew was that Bruce had changed. At first, she thought maybe it was just the kind of dwindling that happens in a long-term relationship. Eventually, she became alarmed. Emma remembers this mystery that was foisted upon her. What is going on? This is not the person that I married. Something is just so off, and I just couldn't figure it out. Emma, 49, is sitting in her friend Fran Gold's Beverly Hills backyard as she recounts these events. It's a hot July day, 2 months before the release of her book, The Unexpected Journey. And Emma is impeccable in jeans, a striped Sherina shirt, and Oliver Peoples bifocals she's still getting used to. She tripped on Gold's front stairs. The former model has the kind of posture that allows her to appear erect even when she leans onto a pillow with her chin resting on her left hand, which bears a textured gold band, a gift from Bruce for their fifth anniversary, in place of her engagement and wedding rings. Gold keeps coming out to refill a pitcher of what she calls cranberry spritzer, a non-alcoholic secret recipe that appears to be cranberry juice and seltzer. She doesn't say it, but Gold is clearly also checking on her friend throughout the interview. In 2022, her own husband, Paul, a musician, died from complications related to early-onset Alzheimer's, a more common form of dementia that impacts memory. Gold was connected to Emma in 2021 by their mutual friend Robert Kraft, not the New England Patriots owner, but a record producer and songwriter Bruce met at a show in New York in 1980 during his bartending years. Bruce slept on Kraft's couch the night before his audition for Moonlighting. Before she was able to get the horrible answer to the question of what was going on with Bruce, Emma was worried Bruce was becoming a person she no longer wanted to be married to after more than a decade. Or that maybe he just didn't love her anymore. "I felt like my marriage was crumbling," Emma says. She considered divorce. Life with Bruce, their romantic, beautiful story, had been a relief, a break from the effort and pressure of all that had happened before she met him. The whole world knows about Bruce Willis. It knows far less about the woman who has become his caretaker, and in doing so, become a voice for the impact of something that will eventually affect us all, the inevitable time when we can no longer care for ourselves. After Emma's parents broke up when she was 7, There were times that she did not see her father for years. Emma's mother, Zarina, who had been a stay-at-home mom, now worked three jobs, including cleaning houses and handing out samples in the grocery store. When Emma was in elementary school, they first followed family to Tottenham, a neighborhood in London that was too rough for Emma to walk through unaccompanied, then moved to Costa Mesa, California. Zarina eventually became an agent. Then, when Emma dropped out of high school to model, she became her daughter's manager. "I wasn't going to grow up to be a doctor or lawyer," Emma says, but she did realize she was profitably beautiful, and she saw a way to take care of her mother. "I wanted to help her so she didn't have to feel like she was in this rat race of just trying to support us," Emma says. Modeling and doing little jobs here and there where you would get a couple $100 was very helpful for us in those early days. Perhaps because her mother was always around for much of her career, Emma realizes now she didn't have these horror stories. "I think I'm one of the lucky ones that came out unscathed." Emma's couple $100 editorial shoots begat lucrative catalog gigs, and by the time she met Bruce at the gym in 2005, Emma was working all over the world, ultimately making enough money to buy multiple properties, including the Chelsea apartment where Zarina stayed when Emma and Bruce lived in New York. At that time, Emma was engaged to someone else. Bruce, however, told his personal trainer and his close friend and right-hand man, Stephen Eads, "I'm going to marry that girl one day." This is the part where everything changes for Emma the first time. It's also the part that she can't quite recall, except in seemingly unbidden moments that burble up. That Bruce's drink was vodka soda with no fruit, because he'd seen so many unclean hands handling lemons and limes in his bartending years. That men, straight men, gay men, whoever men, would seek Bruce out on the street to high-five him. That Bruce had a little crush on Diane Sawyer, so every time he stopped by GMA to promote something, Emma would show up. Bruce and Emma's actual relationship eludes her. "What was our love story? How did we fall in love?" she says, trying to summon what it was like when she was the happiest. "It is so hard right now for me to tap into that time of our life, because I'm so wrapped up in what today is and what it looks like," Emma says. I hear that from a lot of caregivers, too, that it's hard for them to remember. "I'm so happy I'm able to talk to other caregivers now, to know that I'm not crazy, that that is a normal thing." Emma has lost the ability to play Remember When with the only other person who knows those early private moments. It's only Bruce and I that can be able to relive that and talk about that, or even remember that, she says. "I can't talk to anyone else about that." In the photo, past lives, it doesn't matter that Bruce is Bruce Willis. It's just happening to a real human being, and we are having a real experience in this. "I am a caregiver as well as raising young children in this," Emma says, of her new reality. And this photo shows the entire family. Other people love still telling the stories. Ali Cavusi was a modeling agent, now managing partner at the Lions Management, Zarina insisted Emma should be friends with, who has now been her self-described gay bestie for a quarter century. He was with Emma when Bruce started contacting her regularly after they first met. "It's not out of the norm that a model dates a celebrity," Cavusi says, "but there was something about Bruce's messages that were just so humble and sweet and funny. I think he was like love-bombing me," Emma says, laughing, "and I was like, I'll take it. This is great. Now we know that's not really what we should be falling for, but I totally fell for it. I loved it." Cavusi encouraged Emma to stop worrying and love the bomb. And when Bruce invited Emma to his compound at Parrot Cay and Turks and Caicos to celebrate New Year's Eve in 2007, Emma went, with Cavusi as chaperone. "He met us at the dock," Cavusi says of Bruce. "He made us feel so comfortable. It's kind of scary going into what we were going into." Bruce's three daughters from his marriage to Demi Moore were there, as were Moore and her then-husband Ashton Kutcher. Emma and Cavusi were told to put on bathing suits and head to a party at Donna Karen's house next door. Over the trip, Bruce kept asking the chef to make Emma and Cavusi fried chicken so they had enough to eat. When they went out on the water that first day, Bruce repeated his mantra to Cavusi, "I'm going to marry her." 2 years later, he did. It was a small wedding at Parrot Key. Moore, Kutcher and the kids, Zarina, Cavusi, Eads, Kraft and his wife, and two other friends of Emma's with their spouses. Kraft and Kutcher were dispatched by golf cart to pick up Keith Richards, then still in his Stoli and Sunkist era, to play during the sunset ceremony. It was super romantic, Kraft says. He had found a soulmate. She had found the guy that was going to save the world. Emma says she doesn't know what made Bruce know instantly that he wanted to marry her. He can't tell her now. Emma says Bruce's condition takes away the ability to communicate properly with words, though she declined to discuss the specifics of his present state. As Kraft says, their partnership transcends the verbal. We connected so easily, Emma says. It was so effortless. With Bruce, she felt safe from the catastrophes she is prone to imagine. I'm a very fear-based person, Emma says. The day before our interview, she got her first ever iron IV because she was slightly deficient, and the nurse mentioned there's a very low chance of a very rare allergy to something in the IV solution, which they'd only seen once in 12 years. Emma became convinced she was going to succumb to this affliction and pulled out her phone to consult ChatGPT. I go to worst-case scenario, Emma says. That is how insane my brain works. What actually wound up happening to her family had never occurred to Emma to perseverate about. Bruce lived on the opposite pole. Always very in the moment, Emma says. I don't remember really hearing about his stress or anything that he was worried about. That just wasn't Bruce. He'd hear about my shit all day long. He'd be like, chill out. It's going to be okay. What are you worried about? Everything's fine. He's always made decisions, Emma says, of the security and stability of Bruce, whom she usually refers to in the present tense. He's still here. He knows what he wants, and he knows what he doesn't want, Emma says. He is an alpha male. Then she slips into the past of that reality. I loved it. There was a liminal time between the known unknown and the wretched known known as they tried to figure out what was wrong. Even now, Emma still isn't sure when all of this started, which makes the timeline murky. But by 2020, she was sufficiently alarmed that she'd confided in Kraft, who had also been wondering what was going on with his friend. I listened, he says. I was optimistic that everything was temporary, was fleeting, and maybe that was just the Pollyanna in me. Because FTD is rare, with 50,000 to 60,000 cases in the U.S., though that is likely an undercount, and those with the disease are often younger than others with more prevalent forms of dementia, people don't associate its symptoms with any type of brain degeneration. Susan Dickinson, CEO of the Association for Frontotemporal Degeneration, says that expression of FTD can sometimes seem like rude or antisocial behavior. Stealing a pack of gum at the store, or telling someone their dress is ugly. Doctors often misdiagnose the disease as bipolar disorder, or recommend couples counseling. But everyone's disease manifests differently. Only Emma was with Bruce all the time, seeing things that couldn't be gleaned in 30 minutes by someone who didn't know him so intimately. Because Bruce didn't feel like anything was wrong, she eventually had to go over his head to his doctor. Are you kidding? Emma says. When I ask her if Bruce would have been okay with that before he developed FTD. No, it's my husband. No, he knows what's what. He makes the decisions. He's the one. Besides Kraft, Gold, Bruce's doctors, and the family, Emma kept everyone away, desperately trying to protect her very famous husband's privacy, something she now recognizes might have been her own stigma around a disease she had never really thought about. But when she was alone, Emma's life was derailed. She had no idea what was going to happen next. She was trying to parent their young daughters, Mabel, now 13, and Evelyn, 11, while simultaneously keeping the house calm and quiet for Bruce. Emma was doing everything herself, trying treatments, making appointments, grasping for any kind of problem Bruce's symptoms could be attributed to that might have an answer. She wished he would be diagnosed with a benign brain tumor. It is the kind of hope one has only when things are well and truly effed, but a possibility that might mean this could be reversed, and things could go back to how they were. Early on, Emma was also afraid to share what was happening with anyone. It felt like that would make it real. "I was very angry, very upset, very sad," Emma says. "It was really hard for me to just separate what I was pissed at and who I was pissed at. I just wasn't in a good state of mind, and it wasn't good for Bruce. It wasn't good for our children. It wasn't good for anyone, especially not me." In Gold, Emma found someone who understood the pressure of isolation. Gold's also alpha husband had initially made her promise not to tell anyone about his dementia, which became increasingly personally taxing, as well as difficult to hide when his behavior became more noticeably aberrant to friends. Gold told Emma that from surviving that time, she learned just because one person gets the diagnosis doesn't mean both people have to die. Bruce would not be involved with his own coming out process. He and Emma did not yet know this, but the part of his brain that controls self-awareness was deteriorating. Bruce will never understand what happened to his brain. In March 2022, after doctors recognized Bruce's aphasia, a difficulty with communicating and processing language, his family put out a statement. "To Bruce's amazing supporters, as a family, we wanted to share that our beloved Bruce has been experiencing some health issues and has recently been diagnosed with aphasia, which is impacting his cognitive abilities," read the post, signed by Emma, Moore, and their daughters. "As a result of this, and with much consideration, Bruce is stepping away from the career that has meant so much to him." People criticized the decision to have let Bruce continue making movies until that point, which he had done in those last few years with the aid of an earpiece feeding him dialogue. "Filming had been Bruce's decision," Emma says, "and one unimpeded by any diagnosis. When someone wants to work," she asks, "how do you stop someone from working?" With everything she knows now, Emma is glad Bruce kept acting. "He loved what he did," she says. "I'm happy that he was able to do it for as long as he was able to do it." Bruce could still hold a movie with a glare or smirk. "And stop you dead barely matters what the words are," Bruce Willis one-liners. This ability to find what Emma calls cracks of light, another is the fact that she and Bruce never argue anymore, has been hard won. The moment that still traumatizes her today is when Bruce's doctor finally informed them in November 2022 that Bruce had FTD. "There's nothing we can do," they were told. He handed Emma a pamphlet and told her to check in a few months. What was Emma supposed to do with that? There was and is no cure, and Bruce's disease was too advanced for him to enter clinical trials. Though the doctor couldn't tell Emma what would happen next, she never stopped asking. She says the doctor didn't suggest any resources to learn more or experts to consult on how she could make their lives better. The doctor didn't recommend Emma seek mental health care or join a support group or get caregiving assistance. He had no guidance about how to stay sane enough to take care of this new iteration of her family. How do we do this? Emma thought. How do we protect Bruce? How do we protect our family? How do I protect our young girls in this? It was like the worst of the worst. It was really a terrible time. I didn't know that you can ask for help. There's so much guilt when you're thinking that. No, I have to. This is my duty. I must. The doctor certainly didn't tell Emma what it would mean to watch a globally famous icon of everyman virility become, as Gold says, she experienced with her own husband, more and more childlike. So it's like instead of having your husband, it just keeps declining. It doesn't matter that Bruce is Bruce Willis, Emma says. It's just happening to a real human being, and we are having a real experience in this. I am a caregiver, as well as raising young children in this. As Emma was losing the ability to talk with her husband, she was beginning to use her voice publicly. Bruce is able to really highlight it and be able to shine a light on the places that are dark. Dementia is so common, and everyone is talking about it in hushed tones. I didn't want that anymore, especially for our daughters. She and the family announced Bruce's FTD diagnosis on the AFTD website in February 2023. Some early articles seemed to honestly misunderstand Bruce's disease, reporting that his aphasia had progressed into FTD when it was actually a symptom. This may have created the impression that things were declining faster than they were, and opened the door to more misinformation. There was an article, I remember, that came out about Bruce that he has no more joy in his life, or this is his last Christmas, Emma says. She was tempted to try and correct the bad faith record before her youngest stepdaughter, Tallulah, told her it was a waste of time. So Emma decided to focus on people who could actually be reached. In the years since the AFTD announcement, traffic has tripled on the organization's website as Emma became involved in FTD advocacy work. Last year, 25 states officially recognized FTD Awareness Week. This year, a first-of-its-kind FTD bill passed the New York State Legislature that requires medical professionals to report every FTD diagnosis to a new registry of the disease, which is the most common form of dementia for people under 60. Emma went to the New York Capitol to promote the legislation, and she is starting to advocate for a similar law in California. Many publishers ask Emma to do a tell-all. I'm not doing that, she said. She frankly didn't know if she could write any book. Then, around Christmas 2023, Maria Shriver, who runs the Penguin Life imprint, The Open Field, reached out about a pitch she'd seen from Emma's literary agents at CAA, unbeknownst to Emma. Emma was clear about what she would and would not say. This is where I'm comfortable. This is where I'm not comfortable, she told Shriver, who said, Do what you want. I want your book. I want to do this with you. Emma researched and wrote All of the Unexpected Journey in 6 months with co-writer Michelle Bender, with whom she now texts every day. The book uses Emma's story as a bridge to advice from the many experts she repeatedly stresses she is blessed to have the resources to access. It presents dense medical information in a legible way and features advice on everything from what not to do around people with FTD, wear black because the person can process the darkness as a whole and think your head is floating, to specific language to use for children, well-meaning but annoying friends, and people who say, let me know if you ever need anything. Emma does. She has a list to give you if you ask. One thing Emma's book does not cover in detail is the inevitable conclusion. The publisher asks about it, Bender says, but Emma's not there. So you can't even wrap your brain around it. Everything in the book, Bender says, was rooted in her experience. So if she didn't have that experience, we weren't going to put it in. Emma does write that she's learned the average life expectancy for people with FTD is 7 to 13 years after symptoms begin to develop. Emma specifically alludes to that future only in what it might mean for research. She supports families donating their loved ones' brains to science in pursuit of an eventual cure. When I ask if she felt comfortable with brain donation when the subject was initially broached, she says, "It's a lot to take in. It was a lot to learn. But I feel like I'm happy that I did." Emma acknowledges the obvious. I mean, because you're talking about brain donation, you're also talking about it after the person is gone, and that's just a hard pill to swallow. When the time comes, or whenever she asks me anything, or she needs my help or support, I'm there, Gold says. But we haven't gone down that road of, what about when he is gone? That's why they call it the long goodbye. In a lot of ways, he is gone, just like my husband was gone. It's like he's there, but he's not the man I married. For Emma, this is a whole different Bruce than the man she married. Which means Emma is now Bruce's caregiver, though hiring and overseeing a team of professionals who take care of many of the medical responsibilities she used to handle alone has allowed Emma to be his wife again. I ask what it's like to be Bruce's wife without him being able to be her husband. It doesn't even feel like this husband and wife thing, Emma says haltingly. The muddle of putting a name to the love within this horror momentarily breaking her steadiness. We're almost past that. I don't know what you call this, but it's something else. I just feel very connected to him, and I don't know what that label would be. It's just deeper, she concludes, finding the words. He's my person. Emma has secured a home near their own, where Bruce lives with professional care. Now Mabel and Evelyn can make noise and have friends over at the main house and be kids. They, of course, also spend time with their father. Bruce was always wanting them to have fun and have big lives, and he just wants them laughing, Emma says. And she wanted to give everyone in her family a space where they can be as comfortable as possible, including Bruce. What about herself, though? There's plenty of things that I try and do for myself, but I'm always thinking about Bruce, Emma says. He's never off my mind. Because of that, I think it's just easy for me to remain in just the sadness and the grief and just all of it. Bruce has his own way of communicating to us that no one else would be able to understand, Emma says, finding a crack of light. He knows who she is. They hold hands and smile at each other. They cuddle and watch TV. They just exist. This is not what I would want for him, Emma says. This is not what he would want for him. No one would want this for them. But, she says, Bruce is still in the moment. He's still as present as when she first met him, just with everything else stripped away. I can sit there and just all-encompassingly love him, Emma says, who he is today. Exiles in Paris. Live music, dancing, and revolution mingle at a popular Parisian watering hole for journalists, activists, and others seeking refuge from their home countries, by Liam Scott, with photographs by Louis Canadas. Opening photo, Bard. Fellow exiles, Mariam Mana, Tasia Krugoik, Slava Ipatov, Mohammed Maher Akal, and Daria Timchenko all find late-night respite and refuge at the Parisian haunt of Pakistani journalist Taha Siddiqui, also pictured here. Several years ago, the Pakistani journalist Taha Siddiqui believed his greatest risk was being killed by his country's military. Things have changed. Now the threat is just a drunk person, he says lightly, which is easier to manage. It's a Friday evening in July in Paris, and Siddiqui's bar, the Dissident Club, is about to open. Siddiqui cracks jokes as he cleans up dirty glasses from the previous night. Siddiqui, 41, sports long sideburns and a goatee, a smirk, and a fedora. The hat has become something of a uniform for Siddiqui, who says he started wearing them when he opened the bar in 2020. It's sort of a personality thing for a bartender, he says, and they don't say assalamu alaikum, he adds, referring to the Arabic greeting commonly exchanged between Muslims. In 2006, Siddiqui started his career in domestic media, quickly moving on to report for international outlets, including France 24 and the New York Times. In 2014, he won France's prestigious Albert Londres Prize, named for one of the pioneers of investigative journalism. Much of Siddiqui's coverage focused on Pakistan's powerful military. And the military did not like that, he explained simply. In 2018, while Siddiqui was en route to the Islamabad airport, a group of men stopped his taxi, beat him, and tried to abduct him. He managed to escape the car, run into oncoming traffic, and jump into another taxi, then hid in ditches along the highway until he made it to a service road, where he took another taxi to a police station. Soon after, Siddiqui, his wife, and their son fled Pakistan for France, where they have lived as refugees ever since. There is my life before exile and my life after exile, Siddiqui says. For Siddiqui, everything leads back to that attack, which he believes was orchestrated by the military. The government has denied any involvement. In the back of my head, it's always there, he says. The bar itself is a reminder. Siddiqui founded the Dissident Club as a hub for fellow journalists, activists, and others who have fled danger in their home countries for refuge in Paris. Exile can be a lonely experience. You become very depressed, Siddiqui says. The Dissident Club is a rare attempt to combat that isolation and foster community among exiles. Exile is strangely compelling to think about, but terrible to experience, wrote the Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said, who was displaced from Jerusalem as a child. It is the unhealable rift forced between a human being and a native place. Exile was once a common punishment in ancient times. Now, more and more journalists and other dissidents are going into self-imposed exile in order to avoid being imprisoned or otherwise targeted in their home countries, says Tomas Dodds, a University of Wisconsin-Madison assistant professor who has researched exiled journalists. You live in a constant state of dissonance. Russian journalist Daria Timchenko, who fled Moscow in 2022, knows that feeling. So does Afghan journalist Mariam Mana in Paris since 2015 due to death threats in Afghanistan. I work and I cry, she says. Journalist Mohammed Maher Akil fled Egypt after the government labeled him a terrorist. I kept looking out the window at everything because this was the last time for me to see it, he says, of the flight out. The Dissident Club provides a much-needed gathering place. When an exiled journalist feels alone, this club reminds them they are not, Meyer Akel says. The Dissident Club, located in the 9th arrondissement, is playfully irreverent, with red and green walls and multicolored lights. One corner of the bar features a thoroughly punctured dartboard, surrounded by photos of various authoritarian leaders, including Vladimir Putin and Muammar Gaddafi. A neon red sign that reads, "Where dissidents of the world meet," bathes the bar in its glow. In this establishment, eat, drink, rebel is a way of life. Behind the bar, where Siddiqui is making drinks for a growing number of guests, another sign is sandwiched between bottles of Jägermeister and Mezcal. "No, I don't want to hear your life story." Most patrons drink beer or wine, Siddiqui says, but he also likes to serve a custom cocktail he calls the Red Mosque. Made of vodka, limoncello, and Pakistani rose syrup, the drink is a reference to the Red Mosque in Islamabad, where a 2007 battle between militants and the country's military killed dozens. Siddiqui developed the recipe with a friend at an underground party in Pakistan several years ago. "We just wanted to be funny and blasphemous," Siddiqui says. "I would probably get killed for it." But the Dissident Club brings people together. My bar is a small one. It's a cozy place where people come and usually end up making friends, he says. Siddiqui drew inspiration from the Parisian literary cafes that writers frequented in the early 20th century. Besides live music, the bar often hosts book talks and discussions about human rights issues. Airbnb has listed it as an experience in Paris. Siddiqui's own book, a graphic novel called The Dissident Club, Chronicle of a Pakistani Journalist in Exile, is on display. Originally in French, it was published in English earlier this year. The evening I visit, some of Siddiqui's exiled friends stop by, including Rateb Nouri, an exiled journalist from Afghanistan. Nouri moved to Paris following Kabul's fall to the Taliban in 2021. "Even now, when I have an hour free, the first place I think of is the Dissident Club," says Nouri, who works at Agence France-Presse. Nouri doesn't think anywhere other than Kabul will ever feel like home, but he keeps going back to the bar because of the people. "I can relate to them," he says. "They have almost experienced the same things." Other exiles point specifically to Siddiqui. "Taha has empathy. He's very welcoming," says Russian filmmaker Tasia Krugovich. It's hot this evening in the French capital, where air conditioning is still not guaranteed. A few fans do their best to reduce the bar's sauna-like temperature. Live jazz music featuring guitars, a double bass, and eventually a trumpet starts later in the evening as the bar fills with more customers. On other nights, one of the bartenders, an exiled Russian musician named Slava Ipatov, plays the saxophone. Siddiqui stumbled upon jazz when he first moved to Paris, and he quickly fell in love with it. "Jazz is dissident music. It has its own dissident history," he says. Standing on the sidewalk among a cluster of patrons, Siddiqui takes a long drag on his cigarette before squashing it into an overflowing ashtray. "Maybe it has to do with my trauma, but jazz really calms me down," he says. Shortly before 2 a.m, most of the patrons have left for the night. Siddiqui brings in the glasses that guests left outside and sets them on the bar, to be cleaned sometime before the bar opens again the following evening. Taking a final swig of beer, Siddiqui quips that this was a relatively calm night. "Others," he says, "are more spirited. I'm the dissident of the neighborhood," Siddiqui says. Handwritten in white script on the side of the bar's red exterior is an excerpt of an Urdu poem by Habib Jalib, a Pakistani poet who was imprisoned under military dictatorship from the 1960s and 80s. Two lingering drinkers, a neighbor who lives next door, and an Iraqi college student chain smoke on the sidewalk. Siddiqui translates the poem into English, emphasizing one line, I never learned to write with permission. Then Siddiqui locks up the bar, says an efficient goodbye, hops on his bike, and rides into the night. The Florida Divorcee's Guide to Murder. Published in 1983, Hitman, a technical manual for independent contractors, inspired a triple murder and led to a major First Amendment test case. Still, the book is just one chapter in the bizarre story of its until now anonymous author, Rex Farrell. Now a 77-year-old great-grandmother wrestling with decades of guilt. By Abbott Collar. Opening illustration shows that book with blood spatters around it. 1. Ghost. For nearly 30 years, Gail McCool has had a recurring dream about three people she's never met. She is in a quiet cul-de-sac, outside a grand brick house with a picket fence encircling the yard. Yellow police tape winds through the white wooden spikes. Two grown women and a young boy stand on the sidewalk, facing her. The boy calls out her name. McCool forces herself to look at him and says, "But I thought you couldn't talk. You were killed by someone who read my book." "I can talk now," the boy says, "and even walk." He stands and pushes his wheelchair, smiling, as it tumbles down the street. "It's a miracle," McCool says, and as she approaches, she sees that both women have been shot directly through the eye. They join hands with the boy and vanish before McCool has a chance to recite the apology she's memorized, so worn and familiar in her mind. The ghosts haunting McCool are Trevor Horn, his nurse Janice Saunders, and his mother Mildred Millie Horn. They were respectively 8, 38, and 43 years old when they died. When Trevor was an infant, he was left profoundly disabled and quadriplegic after a hospital respirator failed and received about $2 million in a court settlement. Former Motown Records producer Lawrence Horn, Millie's ex-husband and Trevor's father, stood to inherit the money in the event of their deaths. Horn hired a self-proclaimed street preacher named James Perry to kill his ex-wife and son. Before dawn, on March 3, 1993, Perry entered the Horn residence in suburban Maryland. Wielding an AR-7 rifle, a homemade silencer attached to the barrel, he first shot Saunders in the eye. Next, he found Trevor and suffocated him. At the piercing sound of his breathing monitor, Millie rushed to check on him. Perry shot her 3 times in the head, including through the eye. When police investigated, they discovered Perry had purchased a book titled Hitman, a technical manual for independent contractors, a how-to murder guide by the pseudonymous Rex Farrell. Next photos, family ties. Gail McCool, circa 1991. Richard Hance in an undated photo. McCool and Hance during his brief stint as a police officer. McCool's children, Timothy and Tara. In committing this triple murder, Perry had followed 22 of the book's recommendations, including shooting his targets in the eye from a distance of 3 to 6 feet, far enough away to avoid blood splatter, but close enough to ensure the kill. Throughout the ensuing criminal trials against Horn and Perry, and a landmark First Amendment case against Hitman's publisher, Paladin Press, Rex Farrell's identity remained a closely guarded secret. For the first time, the author is revealing her real name and relating the story of how she came to write an infamous murder manual. Rex Farrell is Gail McCool. "This should never have happened," she tells me. "Look at the hearts that broke and the negative impact it had on the world, not just mine. The fact that some little boy who didn't know his own name is dead should not be a thing laid at my door as guilt by association. I am not strong enough to carry it." I first heard of Hitman in May 1999 when I was a young journalist in Philadelphia. Paladin Press's insurance company had just settled with the victims' families for undisclosed millions, a decision that made international headlines. The case was unprecedented. Never before had a publisher been accused of aiding and abetting murder through the publication of a book. Major media organizations that had rallied to Paladin's defense, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Society of Professional Journalists, now pondered the ramifications for free speech. Lost in most of the discussion was Hitman's mysterious author. Only one detail about her life had come to light. She was a divorced mother of 2, living in a trailer park in Florida. I grew obsessed with her. How did this woman come to write a murder manual? What had happened in her life to bring her to that point? I contacted attorney Rod Smalla, who had represented the victims' families, and asked if he had any leads. He told me he had hundreds of documents related to the case and that Rex Farrell's name had been redacted on all but one of them, a fortunate oversight. He wouldn't tell me where in the files to locate it, but I was welcome to visit his office and look for it myself. I did, and after a week of searching, there it was, Gail McCool. I discovered where she lived and wrote to her. At first, she was terrified. She had worried for years that someone would find her and her family. She imagined reporters knocking at her door, waiting outside her work, tracking down her parents, picking out her grandchildren at the playground, shouting ugly questions. Why did you write a book about how to commit murder? What did you do to make your daughter a killer? Did you know your great-grandmother is a murderer? She wrote back to me, demurring. I just want to grow old in peace, she said. I want to sit on my front porch in my rocker and tell my grandkids stories about my life they are certain are fantastic lies. Yet she continued to reply to my emails, revealing more about her life each time, eventually confessing that she found the process cathartic. Often, she'd send 20-page emails prefaced with, "This is more for me than for you." Over the years, I visited her numerous times in Florida. I met her children and grandchildren. We spent long weekends painting her house and drinking cheap wine and smoking cigars. Nellie's hot in here on loop. In 2004, I took her to vote for the very first time. She cast her ballot for John Kerry and remains an ardent Democrat. I wrote a novel based on her life, changing only the locations and names. The response from publishers was unanimous. The story is so much stranger than fiction that it doesn't work as fiction. I put the novel in a drawer and told McCool to let me know when she was ready. 26 years later, she reached out to tell me she finally is. It was a terrible time, but also the best time of my life, she says. I want to give it to you so I don't have to carry it anymore. During another conversation, she says she felt as though that whole period of my life defines me, and shares that in its aftermath, she was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. She is now 77 years old, a great-grandmother and cancer survivor, living in a tidy ranch house across the street from her partner of 10 years, who, until now, had no inkling of her past. A past that includes not only a murder manual, but a long romance with a rogue ex-cop who embodied the Rex Farrell persona, evaded authorities for 7 years, and according to FBI documents, was suspected of being the Unabomber. During the past few months, I interviewed McCool for a total of 60 hours, mostly in person, accumulating a 400-plus page transcript of our conversations. I spoke to her children and anyone I could find from her past. What follows is indeed stranger than fiction. 2. The most beautiful man I had ever seen. All McCool had ever wanted in life was a happy, normal family with healthy children and an adoring husband and a sense that she had control of her own world. Born Gail Daniel in 1948 in Albany, Georgia, the oldest of four children and the only girl, she moved frequently as a child, following her father's construction jobs to Alabama and South Carolina and back to Georgia, a lifestyle that prevented her from making close friends. In high school in Columbus, Georgia, she met a local boy named Ted McCool. He was her first boyfriend. Her father, a sometime Baptist deacon, who was, Gail says, overprotective to a fault, imposed strict rules. She was forbidden to go out on Sunday afternoon unless Ted took her to church in the morning and had a curfew of 11 p.m. From the beginning, Gail says, Ted isolated her from her friends. If she even tried to talk to them, he punched her legs and arms and then apologized profusely, explaining he wouldn't have to hurt her if only she obeyed. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.